U.S. Magistrate Judge Carolyn Ausby's office was largely cleared out when we met November 29, 2016, her next to the last day of full-time duties with the federal judiciary. Really, only one personal item remained in her chambers, a vase of red roses given to her by a friend. She proposed that we walk next door to the conference room to talk. I suggested she bring the roses with her, which she placed on the conference table between us.
How are you going to spend your last day, which is officially tomorrow?
Well, I'm going to conduct a change of plea proceeding in the morning, and that will be my last official action in court as a full-time magistrate judge. Since I'll be on recall status, I may do things in court later, but not as a full-time magistrate, so that will be my last duty in the courtroom. And then the United States Probation Office is having a pizza party at noon for us, and we're very excited about that because they are just a terrific group of people to work with, and they do an amazing job in keeping the community safe and helping offenders, so it's good to celebrate the last day with them.
Has this been somewhat bittersweet for you, or what are your thoughts as you somewhat reflect back on 14 years as a full-time magistrate?
Yeah, it's almost 15. It'll be 15 in February. And what I said is I've been fortunate in my life to have different major changes, as I think most of us do. When I left college and started a job and then law school and then law practice, and I've had a lot of transitions. And it seems like with each one, there's a sense of loss, but a sense of beginning at the same time. And so I feel that same way now. I feel it's a sense of loss in two ways. One is that I feel like I've been given an incredible trust, and I've done the best job that I can in honoring that trust. And the second part of it is just that I've been given an opportunity to work with people of such dedication and integrity throughout the federal court system and beyond, and that has been a real gift. So I will really miss that. I feel a sense of loss about those things, but I also feel a sense of beginning, as I did with other transitions, and that's exciting.
So what excites you is this next chapter, because you're not going away. I mean, you'll still be able to hear cases.
I will, but given the current caseloads, which of course ebb and flow, but given the current caseloads, I don't expect there to be a big demand on recall magistrate judges. I do intend to stay active with the federal courts in other ways through committee work and continue to serve on those committees that I'm on. But I don't expect to be as active. And as for other things, I've decided to take the advice of so many people that have been through this before me that said, just don't make any commitments right away. And that just seemed to make so much sense. And so my nature is to dig in and get involved in something new and commit to this and that. And I have to very few things, but for the most part, I'm just going to enjoy not being committed for a while before I kind of decide what I want to jump into next.
Now, you're still involved in several legal organizations, so what does it mean for those commitments, or have you stepped off some of those committees?
The ones that I'm most involved in now, with the American College of Trial Lawyers, which I will remain a member of course, because I became a member before I went on the bench. I'm on their international committee, and I will continue to serve in that capacity. I'll remain a member of the United States Magistrate Judges Association, and I'm on the international committee of that organization as well, so I'll continue to do that. And then I'll continue to serve on the United States Judicial Conference International Judicial Relations Committee, so you can kind of see there's a common theme here. But I also recently spoke with Chief Justice McGrath and said that I would have more time to serve on commissions that might be of help to the court. And so he called me, and I'm going to be a member of their Commission on Character and Fitness. So I'm trying to stay involved in ways like that that I feel like I can perhaps contribute.
I want to ask you about, and I'm going to get this wrong, the International Judicial Relations Committee, because even now, you've been active and you've been traveling to foreign countries. Can you talk a little bit about what is the purpose of that committee and maybe talk about some of the countries that you visited?
In a nutshell, the committee, it's a committee of the Judicial Conference, and all committee members are appointed by Chief Justice Roberts. And the reason that it exists is to respond to inquiries mainly from executive branch agencies, such as the Department of Justice, the Agency for International Development, the Department of State, with respect to helping promote rule of law around the world. And so when these executive branch agencies engage with governments around the world and they ask for help or ask for some kind of dialogue with the federal judiciary, then our committee is the committee that those requests come to. And we also host delegations from around the world of judges and those who work in the justice sector. And sometimes countries around the world will contact the judiciary directly. And we try to respond to those as well as we can. We have no funding of our own. So we do not get to pick and choose and say, well, we'd like to go to Namibia or take your pick. We are just there as a resource. We don't have our own agenda, except that we all so strongly believe in the rule of law and the importance of an independent judiciary to the freedom of peoples. And so we're all dedicated to that, but we are a reactive committee otherwise.
So you visited, we were talking on the phone, and one of the countries that you visited was Jordan. Were you invited then to that country, and what did you do?
Well, with respect to that trip, I went with the magistrate judges group to Germany and Poland, and we met with judges in Germany and in Poland. The reason that I went to Jordan initially was because my daughter was living there in Amman. But we also let, as committee members, let the State Department know when we are traveling abroad, and then they take advantage of that because, as I said, we don't have money as a committee. But if, as individuals, we're traveling anyway, we let them know. And they call us targets of opportunity. And so we then become a target of opportunity. So then our contact within the State Department contacted people in Amman, and they set up two meetings for me. One was with a member of the Jordanian Constitutional Court, which is a new court, which was just created after the Arab Spring. And so they're just getting started, and it was fascinating to talk to that judge about how they are doing their work and they're setting up their procedures. They also set up a meeting for me with the Arab Women's Action League, and the Arab Women's Legal Network is what that part of it was called. And so I met with, there were about 10 women, all of them either judges or lawyers, or there were a few law students. And somewhat to my surprise, only two of them spoke any English, so we had to conduct our conversation through an Arab interpreter. But we met for about 3 hours, and I learned so much. I don't know how much I was able to share with them because I was so eager to hear their stories. For example, there was a woman from Yemen that was a lawyer in Yemen that had fled when the war there started. And it was really moving to hear the stories of these women. So that's what I did in Amman.
And where else have you traveled, and what are some of the other stories that you've taken away?
Well, the first trip that I took for the committee was to Mexico. Because in 2008, Mexico changed its constitution so that their judicial system will have oral hearings. Before, they are a civil law country, as are about two-thirds of the nations around the world, unlike the United States. But they decided that they wanted to work on their rule of law in Mexico, and that they thought that having oral hearings would help promote that. But they'd never done it. No oral trials. For example, in a criminal case, a defendant would be charged and go all the way through sentencing, and the judge would never see the defendant because there would be no hearings. So they changed that. So our government, through the Department of Justice and also through various legal institutions, universities and all, have been trying to help Mexico to create the mechanisms that they needed and to train law students. And it's not just law students, it's, of course, prosecutors and defense lawyers and police agents in how to get a case ready for an oral hearing. And so that's what we went down for a week, and we met with 30 judges, federal judges at various in various places that came to Puebla, Mexico, and it was properly termed a judicial dialogue, and that's what it was. We listened, and they listened, and we met, and then we went and watched a proceeding, and it was fascinating. I have to say, it was only a part of the immense effort that's gone into this total change that Mexico is making.
Has there been a country and meeting with colleagues in that country that you find memorable?
That's a good question, but my honest answer is they're all memorable. I'm just fascinated with how different people organize themselves with respect to the question of justice. I was sharing with you earlier about my trip to Egypt. I went to Egypt in March, and I was there for a week. And once again, it was fascinating in that the reason that I was asked to go as a delegate of the Speaker's Bureau of the Department of State was to a United Nations conference on advancing women in the administration of justice, or the role of women in the administration of justice. And so I served on a panel at that UN conference with judges from the UK, Tunisia, Lebanon, Spain, and Egypt. And just sitting on that panel and having that kind of, I'll call it cross-pollinization, about how our various countries are working to advance the role of women in the administration of justice, and what our histories have been and what our experiences have been, was really moving.
So let me ask you this. Did you walk away listening, after listening to your colleagues, with thinking, wow, they have something here that maybe we need in the United States?
I have to laugh. Yes, and they would give me a bad time because their constitution guarantees equal rights for women in Egypt. Now, of course, that's only a very small part of the question. Their judiciary is less than 1% female judges. But nonetheless, they were very proud to say that they have a constitutional provision guaranteeing equal rights for women, and that they knew that our Equal Rights Amendment never passed. So I just offer that as, there is definitely a conversation, let me say it that way.
Certainly. Well, I guess it's a roundabout way of asking, does the U.S. have all the answers? As you go as a representative of this judicial system.
Well, you know the answer to that. Absolutely not. I was struck when I was in Egypt, which of course has immense challenges these days, that it's a civilization that's thousands of years old. And our little democracy is just a baby. We've only been around as a democracy for less than 300 years. And so we better be pretty careful about going around purporting to tell other people how they have to conduct their business. That's not to say that we can't share our thoughts about the importance of the rule of law. And that's what we're doing. We're not there to preach. We're there to discuss how each of us, in our own ways, through our own cultures, through our own laws, can promote justice for people. And that's really what our focus is. It isn't to preach, and we all know nobody's going to listen to us if that's the attitude we have either. And the other thing I would add is that all our governments are fragile if the citizens don't treasure them and participate in them and take their role as citizens seriously. And that means voting, serving on juries, doing all the things that are guaranteed rights, but they're also obligations. And as I travel around and am exposed directly to the challenges of other nations, it just brings home even more how seriously we need to take our challenges here too. We can't take things for granted. We have to get involved, and we have to, with integrity, do our job and fulfill our role as citizens.
So you see yourself continuing with this international committee?
Well, you can tell I'm kind of a zealot about it. I do. I feel that I've really been given an opportunity that not many people have to engage in these kind of dialogues around the world. And I just find them fascinating. But even more than that, I find them so important because it is about people being free, and it is about people having rights and having a place that they can trust, that they can go to enforce those rights. It doesn't mean every country is going to be the same. They aren't. But there is a basis in terms of being able to seek justice and a fair hearing.
And that's the role of the judicial branch.
Right. That is the role of the judiciary, is that constitutions can be written and they can be very lofty sounding, but unless you have a place that can fairly hear disputes and apply those constitutional provisions and apply the law in a fair and balanced manner, they're just words on a paper. And that's why the judiciary is just vital, and the independence of the judiciary is vital. And I think judges have to take that role more seriously than anybody else because they've been given the trust to fulfill that role.
When I listen to you, I go back in time to when you have overseen the naturalization ceremonies in your courtroom. And I have to say, I've been moved. Is that something that you're going to miss? That's certainly very different from the normal business of a magistrate.
It is different, and I think any judge you talk to who is able to preside over naturalization proceedings will say the same thing, is that it's a joyous proceeding in federal court, and there aren't many joyous proceedings in court because by nature they're disputes, and it's dispute resolution. But at a naturalization, there are no disputes. It's just everybody being pretty happy that they got to the end of a long and difficult process, and maybe after some difficult decision-making that they had to do. It's the oath, I'm sure you remember it. It's a powerful oath that they take, and so it is fun, and I will miss that.
Anything else that you're going to miss?
Well, as I said, I'll miss the people. But I really think that for me, change is good, and I'm really looking forward to the changes.
So you're going to have more free time, perhaps, to go hiking and enjoy being on your bike and just maybe traveling for fun?
Yep, head for the hills. Yep, I have a season ski pass I intend to use a lot, get my money's worth out of that. Be outside in the middle of the day doing things that, for a while I just want to do things like that I haven't been able to do really since I was a kid.
Right, and enjoy your children.
Yes, that's right. More time for friends, more time for family. Yeah, I've told my kids you're going to get so sick of me.
Let me ask you this, just sort of in closing. Do you have any sort of thoughts or words of advice to your successor, Tim Cavan?
I would not purport to give him any advice. He is so experienced, and he'll have a great temperament for the job. And we've already had several meetings, and I think the transition will be seamless. And I have the utmost confidence in his ability to handle the job superbly.
So you said when we were talking on the phone that you would be in the background and maybe, what, not even for his investiture?
Well, I have to leave for personal reasons, so I won't be there for the investiture, and I've already made my apologies to him for that I can't be there because it's a very happy day for him.
But do you have any words that you maybe want to say to him?
Well, not that I haven't already said, just congratulations. It's a terrific job. I followed, when I was hired, Judge Siebel had been in the position that I took. And he told me when I became a magistrate judge that he thought it was one of the best jobs in the federal system. And I agree. I think it's for me, it was a great place to be, and I'm sure it will be for him too, and I just wish him the best.
Well, let me ask you a more general question, because you've had, I'm not meaning to sound like you're dead, okay, Carolyn, a very distinguished legal career, and you've seen so many changes, whether it's being an attorney in private practice to being on the bench. And so what would you say to young women who are either looking at going into a legal career or in school? What would you say to them? Given your experience?
Work hard. I think that's what it's about. I think that they have to work hard. They have to show up, as some would say, lean in. It's so different than when I started because there were so few women in the law practice when I started. And although at that time they thought there were a lot because there had been just one or two, and now there were maybe, you know, a dozen, so that seemed like a lot. Now, of course, a lot of law school classes are over 50% women, so it's very different. But I think it's the same advice that I would give to young men. Act with integrity, be honest, be professional, treat people right, whether it's your client, or opposing counsel or the court. Be honest. I'm starting to feel real preachy here. I don't mean to be, but it's just the basics. Remember the basics. Work hard and treat people right.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Judge Carolyn Ausbee, Esquire, for sitting down and chatting with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. I enjoyed it.